Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Julian Zelizer is joining us momentarily here. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. There's a very important vote going on as we speak. It does look like House Republicans have the votes to pass their health care bill, and we should have the final vote in minutes, and we will announce that and talk about it with Professor Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, a pioneer in the revival of American political history. He's written many books, most recently The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, and The Battle for the Great Society. He's written on the presidencies of George W. Bush, Conservatives in Power, the Reagan Years, Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, the Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He's a frequent commentator in the international and national media on political history and contemporary politics. He writes a weekly column on CNN.com and is one of the most well-spoken people I've ever heard. And so it's always a delight to have him with us. We are going to welcome phone calls. We'll go from topic to topic this hour, so feel free to join us whenever you would like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Julian Zelizer, a pleasure to have you with us again, sir. Hello.
Hi, thanks
Hi.
For having me.
Well, as we're speaking, and we'll get the numbers, the final numbers in a moment, it does look like the House Republicans have the votes to pass the health care bill. Why do you think, Professor Zelizer, they're rushing this?
Well, I think part of it is a political calculation that President Trump needs some kind of victory, a legislative victory, sooner rather than later. And before they leave and go back to the states and the districts, they want to have this done. Just as important, though, I think this is a tactic. You try to get the bill through before too much information is out there. We don't know how much this is going to cost.
Right.
We don't know the exact effects. So you pass it, you get everyone on board, and you fight the aftermath, the backlash later. And so I think that's the other reason they're moving quickly.
We've heard that it's going to have a pretty rough time in the Senate, even if it passes the House. Do you think that there will be some form, modified form of the House bill that would pass the Senate?
Yeah, I don't think we should discount that. It's clear that a lot of Senate Republicans are anxious about this bill, and if there's more unrest about the provisions as they become clear, a lot of Senate moderates certainly won't be eager to move forward with this. But there will be a momentum if this passes. There'll be more pressure on Senator McConnell, the leader of the Republicans, to put something together. The White House will certainly lean hard on them. And it's possible we see something like we just saw in the House, some cobbled together compromise that does enough to repeal the program and enough to calm some of the anger about the benefits being lost to move forward with a victory. So I wouldn't automatically discount this, given what we're watching in the House right now.
Mm-hmm. Is it unusual, when you look at this historically, for the Congressional Budget Office to not have time to look at how many people would be affected, how many people may lose their insurance, which is a pretty big deal? This is near and dear to all of us. Be you a Republican or a Democrat, it could come back to haunt the Republicans if a lot of people lose insurance. Don't they want to know?
Well, you would think so. Some of them are probably going on the assumption that generally this will be what the last Congressional Budget Office report was, which was not good.
Right.
Millions would lose, but they're okay with that. A lot of these members come from very red districts where even with the loss in coverage, they are happy to get rid of this government program, a regulatory program, and are betting that a freer market will do better things. And they're also reading the news about states like Iowa, where insurance companies are pulling out of the exchanges.
Right.
And so I think they balance this out, and they anticipate that once this is in effect, it will just work out. They will try to work this out in a way that's politically feasible.
Mm-hmm. Professor Zelizer, a lot of Republicans have said, and some Democrats have said, there are problems with Obamacare, but a lot of Republicans have said that Obamacare is failing. Is it?
I don't think it's failing. I don't think it's a perfect piece of legislation. It's succeeded very well in bringing millions of people into insurance markets, both through the exchanges and through the Medicaid expansion. I think one of the biggest challenges has been the ongoing uncertainty about the program, which doesn't make insurance companies feel very good about the program. And the inefficiencies in enforcing the mandates, which were actually essential to bringing people into the program. So in some ways, the Republicans have subverted the program and now can claim it's not working so well. But even with that, I think there's been a lot of success as well. It's like most legislation is not perfect, and what's really more important than repeal is to fix. But it doesn't look like there's a lot of political space to do that right now.
I remember doing show after show after show when the Affordable Care Act was being fashioned and getting everybody at the table, everybody saying we have to do something about costs. That hasn't really happened. It's still quite expensive. Why is it so darn difficult? And if we get something that the Republicans put together, we've already had something the Democrats put together, and if the Republican plan doesn't work, do we find ourselves one step closer to single payer, or is that considered too socialist for America?
Yeah, it's not something you'd want to bet on. We've had a problematic health care system for decades. We have this private health system, which formed a long time ago, and we've gradually increase the role of the federal government, but it's this jerry-built system with private insurance markets and hospitals and federal programs and money as well. And it's kind of a mess. And we try to keep fixing it with Band-Aids and patches. And this was a critique of the ACA from the left. The problem is it's hard to imagine moving to a more robust government program given the direction both of Congress and the White House right now.
Right. And we just got word that it did pass 217 to 213, so it was a fairly close vote, right?
Yes, close, but that's all you need in the House.
Right.
So they weren't looking for a landslide. They were just looking for a victory. And the headline will say that the bill passed, not just that it passed by narrow margins. I think also in this day and age, I think people are used to that.
Right before we went on the air, I was looking actually at CNN, and they were saying that there are buses ready to house Republicans to take a trip to the White House where maybe they'll have cake, huh?
Sure, there will be celebration. Make no doubt about this. This will be seen as a victory, even with all the doubts about whether it can pass, even with all the fears about what members are going to be facing when they go back to the district. This was the central promise of the Republicans
right. Since
the bill passed. They will replace it or they will repeal it, and some want to replace it. And the House, at least, has done that. And for President Trump, who has struggled on the legislative front, he will be happy about this. And also, it shows that the two can work together, meaning the congressional Republicans and President Trump, at least in this glimmer of legislative progress from their perspective, have succeeded in coordinating politically and fixing a political problem. So.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be cake and celebration for sure.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. The House just passed the Republican health care plan. Vote was 217 to 213. We'd like to hear your immediate response. Nobody knows exactly what is in this plan, nor do we know how many people would be losing their insurance. We don't know how much money it would cost either, because the Congressional Budget Office has not had time to really look at this and give us the numbers to find out the answer to all of those questions. Is that troublesome to you? Do you think Obamacare is failing? We'd really love to hear from you. This is breaking news. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, to break down the numbers fully. The Republicans, 217 votes, yay, 20 votes, no. The Democrats, 193 votes, no. Well, we have a lot more to talk about. We're going to be looking at James Comey's testimony yesterday, notifying Congress about new emails in the Hillary Clinton investigation, saying that it made him mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. We'll discuss that and much more with Julian Zelizer. Terrific guest always, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books. He's written about many U.S. presidents, and he's a CNN commentator talking about the news of the day. This is the Ideas Network. We are in our spring membership drive, and you should know that your support is the foundation of our budget. It what It is what makes this place your place to go for great programs and guests like the one you're hearing now. We'll get back to Julian in a moment. Lisa Nalbandian is with me. We're encouraging you to go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 at this very moment to make your gift in support of all the programs that you love.
Yeah, before 2 o'clock, Kathleen, we need 9 more
all
pledges.
Right, we're getting there.
Yeah, we're going to get there. Pledge by pledge. Your gift right now, really important. This is the last day that you can pitch during the Kathleen Dunn Show. So keep, or pledge during the Kathleen Dunn Show. So keep that in mind and support the programs you rely on every day.
Thank you so much if you've already given. And if you have not, the time is now. Give at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You know, when you think back 100 years to our founders, I'm sure they could not have imagined where we'd be today.
Right, I know.
We have almost 500,000 listeners every single week, and they enjoy 24 hours of programming each day. Maybe they probably couldn't have imagined that we'd have a comprehensive website at WPR.org. I'm guessing not.
No, probably not.
Or that we'd have tens of thousands of shows, hours of shows available on demand.
And today we can't imagine where we'll be 100 years from now, other than beings from some other planet may come and visit us. That happens in my lifetime. But we can know, just as our founders did 100 years ago, that we're creating an amazing future, and you make that future happen when you give at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
That's 100% correct, Kathleen. And a really great way to share your passion for WPR is becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle, and that takes a pledge of $100 a month or $1,200 a year or more. We rely on member support, your support, to make great radio.
Gifts of $100 a month are an important part for our future. So still help us continue to grow with your leadership gift. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
I mean, really, whether your pledge is $5 a month or $100 a month, we appreciate and count on your gift.
Absolutely, we do. And we want to always know how much we appreciate you. We appreciate your call-ins. We appreciate your minds. Think about for a moment what you might spend a dollar a day on. It might be coffee. It might be your phone, a snack from the vending machine. It's easy to spend a dollar a day on something that's part of your daily routine.
And think about Wisconsin Public Radio in equation. Yeah, WPR is your daily news source, a conversation starter, your place, really, to learn more. It's your public radio. Support it today and every day. Give a dollar a day. That's $30 or $31 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have 9 pledges to go and probably about 33 minutes to get those. Your gift now gives us a strong start to the next 100 years. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And this pledge drive, do more with your gift to WPR. Ask to plant a tree in our centennial forest as your gift when you give $5 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
What a nice thing. Your centennial forest.
I know.
Oh, that's good.
Sounds magical to me.
That's great. Yes, it does. Pamela from Columbus says, WPR keeps me calm and makes me more aware of what's happening in the world. We sure do make you aware of what's going on. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, join Pamela from Columbus. Make your pledge right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Julian Zelizer is our guest. We're talking about the House vote, which just took place to pass a health care bill. Julian has been with us many times before, and we're going to move into James Comey and President Trump's knowledge of history. But because this health care vote happened just within the last few minutes, we're getting some response to it. So we'll start with a couple calls. Ryan at Camp Douglas is our first caller. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I would just like to call and say that I think it's a good thing that they're repealing and replacing it. It's not done anything. It was actually made to fail right from the get-go.
Has it affected you personally, Ryan, the Obamacare?
No, it has not, because I have an employer that offers insurance. But it does. It would have eventually. It would have driven up prices in our healthcare industry, too.
Hmm. Everybody's talking about prices going up. I can't figure whose plan has been outlined, Julian, that doesn't have prices going up.
Well, that's true, and I think that gets to part of how the politics unfolds. There's an assumption, I think, by many commentators that, look, people will realize what benefits are being lost, or they will make arguments about what's going to happen to prices now that this is gone. But a lot of this is about framing the debate. I think people have very different perspective. What's the cause behind the increases? Obamacare, ACA supporters would say it would have been a lot worse without the program, and that's what's going to happen now. The cost containment was actually having a positive effect. But that's about framing the debate, you know, and I think different voters in our partisan era are going to see the problems in very different ways, and that's where the politicians will scramble to say their bill, their solution is a better choice.
Thanks, Ryan, for your call. Rachel in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I'm so disheartened that the representatives would have voted for a bill that would limit or cut out pre-existing conditions, would possibly, and I haven't heard everything about the bill, that there be caps, lifetime caps, where you might not get insurance after you've used up a certain dollar amount, and also the mental health coverage. I cannot understand how the public has not called their representatives, emailed their representatives, and taken a stand on these. I think I am old enough to remember a time when you had to wait a year or more for coverage if you had a pre-existing condition and pay the bills by yourself. There are a lot of people, I think, that don't remember that or don't want to remember it.
There is confusion about the pre-existing conditions, isn't there, Professor Zelizer?
Well, yeah. The final compromise that was worked out literally in the last 24, 48 hours, basically, I think, is in part meant to create a little bit of confusion. So the legislation still has that coverage, but states are allowed to apply for waivers to opt out of that. And then in another part of the final amendments, there are going to be federal subsidies to help compensate people with pre-existing conditions to enter into high-risk pools. But a lot of independent organizations are saying that's just not going to cover the costs. So the legislation really won't cover that anymore. And I think that's one area where Democrats are hoping that before this gets through the Senate, that voters make their positions clear, that this is a kind of coverage they like.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's move on to James Comey defending his decision to notify Congress about the new emails in the Hillary Clinton investigation before Election Day. His comments, widely quoted today, it makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. Should those emails have been released? Should there have been, although it was under investigation, and he said that he had to wait for the first Hillary Clinton email thing to be closed, and then he made a comment, and then there was new information. Do you feel that it was right for him that he was actually had no choice but to talk publicly about the new investigation? And what about the Trump investigation, which he didn't say anything about? And the third question in that whole package is, what do you think will happen from the House and the Senate Intelligence Committee investigations concerning Russia?
Well, I think the first two questions go hand in hand. He obviously did have a choice because he chose not to talk about the Russian investigation, which was at least equally important, if not much more important and threatening. And so you see in that decision that both he and President Obama, frankly, were able to say, we're not going to release this before an election. So it's really unclear, even after his testimony, why he had to make public what was going on with Anthony Weiner's computer and those emails. And I don't think he's going to make everyone or anyone much happier who was upset by that decision, given the way in which it really swung the election. As to the investigation, you know, it's continuing. It's been bogged down by partisanship, meaning there's been a lot of Republican opposition to really moving forward with an aggressive investigation. That's getting worse. Even in the Senate, we're seeing that play out. And look, we are now pretty far into both this presidency and the investigation, which might suggest that this is not going to have the kind of political legs that some people think it should.
Interesting. What about the FBI's investigation?
Well, that's the one people think is it could be most damaging, because that is theoretically free from partisan influence. So we don't know. Look, this could end up the FBI finding evidence of many campaign officials having connections with the Russians. But if it doesn't touch President Trump, if we don't have that kind of smoking gun evidence, this could be like Iran-Contra, the scandal in Reagan's presidency that ultimately didn't bring him down because it was about his advisors and not him.
Hmm. All right, let's move into some of Trump's lack of knowledge about history. Maybe I should start this segment by asking you, why was there a civil war in the first place?
Yeah, most historians these days agree it was about slavery and that the institution of slavery led this country toward that war because we didn't eliminate that institution. There are few who think that any president really could have stopped this from happening. And many historians responded to that comment by saying it's not clear it would have been in the best interest of the nation not to have it and keep that institution intact. So there, you know, there was an older view that it could have been avoided, that it wasn't inevitable. That's many, many decades ago. I think the majority of historians have now moved toward the perspective I just outlined.
And the president didn't seem to have a sense of history here when he was talking about his hero, Andrew Jackson. I quote here, he was a very tough person, but he had a big heart. He was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said there's no reason for this, even though he died 16 years before that happened. You were quoted in the New York Times on Sunday saying presidents should have some better sense of the nation's history as they become part of it. That seems fair. They should.
Yeah, and I'm not someone who jumps every time a president or politician makes a mistake about something in history. This happens. They're not. This is not what they're doing full time, and it's natural that that happens. But I think part of the reason this story about the Civil War and President Andrew Jackson resonated a little bit was just his general demeanor, President Trump, that he just doesn't at least convey a sense of appreciation and commitment to the institution that he is now inhabiting. And I think that's why when you hear this, it kind of reflects a broader attitude that he has toward politics, toward the presidency, and toward government altogether that's troubling for many people who watch this on a day-to-day basis.
Hmm. And yet Newt Gingrich has said, Trump's not a student of history. He's an extraordinarily successful entrepreneurial personality who learns what he needs to know when he needs to know it. Trump is learning history as he governs. Is that okay?
Well, it's fair that he's not a historian, true. But most presidents do develop a keen sense of the institution they are inhabiting, that they are the president of the United States. They understand the presidents who came before them, and they have a very strong feel for the impact and importance of what they are doing to this republic. Maybe he's learning. We don't know that. There's a lot of evidence he's not. His tweets, if you just follow that stream, suggest he's not. So the verdict's out, and perhaps former Speaker Gingrich is correct, but I think many people haven't seen that learning curve yet.
I like this idea. I know that President Obama did this, and I believe that you met with him, too, as a wonderful historian, knowledgeable guy. Meet with historians to find out about other presidential administrations, because obviously if you're president of this huge job, the most important job in the world, it's good to know what your predecessors had to face.
It is good. I mean, I think there is room for presidents and members of Congress to learn a little bit about how other people have handled this job and some of the challenges that the institution has faced. It's not the only kind of learning a president needs to do. I mean, and it might not be the most important, but it certainly should be a part of the mix, because the fact is, history does not constantly remake itself, and presidents are dealing with recurring challenges over the years. And I think there's great insight for their own political self-interest that can come from understanding how their predecessors have handled policy challenges, political challenges, and institutional challenges.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest this hour, we'll welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. He has joined us many times before. We thank him particularly for being here during our pledge drive. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's frequently on television as a commentator in the international and national media on contemporary politics and political history. He has a weekly column on CNN.com, and he's written a ton of books. So we'll continue momentarily. This is also Wisconsin Public Radio's Spring Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian. And you know you're always going to hear something interesting when you tune into this show. Julian's a fantastic guest. He's in high demand on television. He's a scholar, and we love having him with us. Today we're asking you to put a value on this program and everything else that you hear at WPR by making a gift. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Yeah, we have about 20 minutes left to the top of the hour, and we're still looking for seven more pledges. Remember, your support right now keeps WPR strong and helps pay for the Kathleen Dunn Show. So make your gift right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
I know you enjoy having Julian on the air. You frequently have told us that. We do all kinds of programs on historical topics. We've talked about Jimmy Carter a couple days ago. It was FDR. We do presidential history. We do a lot of current events, current affairs. So this is an example of what we do all the time. So take a few minutes to help us out.
That's right. Take a few minutes. Make this hour and so many more hours possible. And it's really easy. When you go to WPR.org or when you call 888-202-2552, really, it's just name, address, phone, amount you'd like to give. That's all it is. Make your pledge, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And you'll feel so good when you do it. Make your pledge in the form of an ongoing monthly gift of maybe $15 or $20 a month. You can set that up on your credit or debit card, or better yet, right from your bank account. And when you make that sustaining gift, you don't have to remember to renew your support every single year.
Yeah, your support will be as consistent as, you know, your WPR listening.
Right.
Month after month, year after year. So become a sustainer right now by making an ongoing gift at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You're busy. It can be difficult to squeeze in all the day's to-dos, but no matter how challenging your schedule is, it's always fast and convenient to make your contribution to WPR Online. Just go to WPR.org. With secure online pledging, you can pick the amount you want to give, how you'd like to pay, and even ask for a thank you gift. It's secure, quick, and pledging your support is a simple, easy task that has a huge impact. It funds all the in-depth news, thoughtful conversations, and excellent music and entertainment that are a part of your everyday, no matter how busy things get. So give now at WPR.org. Of course, you can always give us a call at 888-202-2552.
Again, that's 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Lisa Nalbandian is joining me here in Milwaukee, and we're asking for your support of WPR. It's our spring membership drive. Your gift might be $10 a month, maybe $20 a month. We thank you for your gift.
Now is the time. You can pledge right now when you're thinking about it. It takes just a few minutes.
You'll have the good feeling of supporting the programs that you love. Join, renew, or make an extra gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for six more pledges before 2 o'clock. I think we can do it. 2017 marks 100 years of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listeners, you make it all possible. Your gift today makes sure a bright future for the programs you rely on every single day. Make your centennial gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Isn't that something? We're 100 years old. That's such an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. You can support the radio that you love and you have loved for 100 years, or at least some of your ancestors have loved that before you did. And you can also ask to plant a tree. I like this one as your gift. Pledge now and grow a tree when you give $5 a month or more. What a good thing to do. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. 2552.
You can also become a sustainer right now. It's super easy to set up convenient monthly donations from your bank account or credit card. You can do that too at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you ever so much for all of your support. And we need you, too. So thank you, but we need you.
That's true. That's true. And I love this quote from Johanna in Madison. Public radio has been part of my life since before I could talk. My parents would drive me around to help me fall asleep as a baby, listening to public radio in the car. I'm so glad I can give back and keep WPR going for another generation of listeners. Well, thank you so much. Join Johanna in Madison, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And now public radio keeps her awake.
Right.
All these
years
later, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Lisa. Julian Zelizer is our guest, and we're taking phone calls. Let's go to Matt in Middleton next. Hi, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
And the comment that is that I think that the way Trump views the presidency is very different than what many contemporary politicians think the presidency should be viewed. I think Trump sees it as another executive position, as, you know, just like any other company executive position, and is treating it that way. And his comments about Andrew Jackson, I think maybe more about his financial dealings and what he did for the country than maybe some of his other less popular political ambitions. And two, the question is more on the international stage with what's occurring in France between Macron and Le Pen, and how the media here and over there paints Le Pen as being far right. But if you actually investigate her politics, I would say they're very much centrist and Macron is very far left. And
I wouldn't call her centrist. Professor Zelizer, what do you say?
Yeah, I think I don't see that's what President Trump is saying when he points, as he often does, to Andrew Jackson. I think at some level he's just arguing this was a tough president, really hearkening to his military background. I think he is talking as much about himself as Jackson, saying that someone who knows how to do things, who can make a deal, can just move politics and get over crises when necessary. Andrew Jackson also resonates with this conservative populism that he's often talked about. He is a key figure in this kind of rhetoric, which is appealing to white working and middle class Americans with a range of issues, from attacking free trade to using rhetoric about nativism and xenophobia as a way to whip up that vote. And Jackson's a figure in those kinds of arguments because of his policies to Native Americans, because of his history as a slaveholder. He fits directly into that. And I think that's both of those are the ways, frankly, in which President Trump tries to use him. You know, overseas, it's hard to see Le Pen as something other than extension and incarnation of a pretty far-right kind of politics, particularly on issues like immigration. Mm-hmm. And that's what resonates, I think, with her. It's the same kind of arguments that part of the Trump campaign used to appeal to disaffected voters.
Mm. Actually, I find that election is very interesting, but I had no idea until yesterday, Julian, that Macron's wife is 24 years older than he is, and how many French women think this is pretty good because men have younger wives, so why don't women have younger husbands?
No, that's an interesting part of the campaign. And we just saw how these gender issues are still front and center in how voters think of candidates. And this is a reversal and a little bit of a difference in some of the familiar images that we see in politics.
Absolutely. Thanks, Matt, for your call. We go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi.
Appreciate your time. I just have a couple statements. I've always considered myself a moderate, and I still am puzzled by so many people voted for Trump after he showed his true self during his election. And I just am very disappointed that 43%, they said, of registered voters did not vote. And I was wondering, how are we going to be able to get those people back into the election and interested in our country again so they will come vote? Does anybody have any idea on that?
Well, certainly one step that will be important is to move away from what we've seen in the last few years in many states, which is a move toward making voting more difficult. And so this is something that has been discussed and analyzed. Voter restriction laws have really been damaging, I think, to actual levels of voting, but also just to how we think of voting. All this talk about voter fraud that really doesn't exist and the actual laws that make voting harder, I think we need to move away from that. But that's only part of it. In the end, you need candidates who inspire. And many people look back for the Democratic election and don't just see the problem being about the Russian intervention and those sorts of issues, but about the inability of Hillary Clinton to truly inspire large numbers of Democrats. So that's important, too. And then finally, some of it's mechanical. You know, get out the vote is something that parties need to do. Republicans have done a pretty good job at it, especially at the state and local level, in state and local politics. And I think Democrats need to put some work into that. Those are the ways in which you get people to vote. There's no magic to doing it. It's just working at all levels.
Who has inspired you? And you don't necessarily need to have been alive because you're a historian, so you've studied many different presidents. Who's inspirational?
Well, certainly I always tell people Franklin Roosevelt's just a pretty inspirational president, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Just to see a president guide the nation through two major crises and to put together a massive political coalition that will last for decades, that's presidential leadership. And his ability to communicate to Americans in an intimate way, even though he was as far removed from them as any other president, is a real skill. And I think it was really important to helping people understand why we were in a depression, how we'd get out of it, and why we were going to war, what it would achieve, and how it would end. So I always think of him as really one of the models for presidential leadership. Again, both parties can look to him and I think gain some of these lessons.
And finally, I wanted to play this because I thought this was an extraordinary interview. This is John Dickerson, who had an interview with the president on Saturday or Sunday of last weekend for CBS's Face the Nation. The president went on and on about surveillance, even though the FBI has said this did not happen. There was no surveillance of Trump Tower by President Obama. And yet he was on this again. And he does this every now and then. I want you to respond to it. First, let's just hear a little bit of that interview.
Did President Obama give you any advice that was helpful? That you think, wow,
he was very nice to me, but after that, we've had some difficulties. So it doesn't matter. You know, words are less important to me than deeds. And you saw what happened with surveillance, and everybody saw what happened with surveillance.
Difficulties how?
I thought that, well, you saw what happened with surveillance, and I think that was inappropriate.
What does that mean, sir?
You can figure that out yourself. Well, I think that is a very big surveillance of our citizens. I think that's a very big topic, and it's a topic that should be number one, and we should find out what the hell is going on.
I just wanted to find out, though, you're the president of the United States. You said he was sick and bad because he attacked
you. You can take it any way you want.
That was a very unusual conversation.
Very unusual. First of all, words do matter, especially when they're the words of the president, and that's actually the issue here, because we didn't see what happened, and so far all the evidence is what he said happened didn't happen. And so he is making an accusation about a former president. He's continuing to make the accusation when there's no evidence that Obama ordered this wiretap on him in Trump Tower, and it's damaging. It's damaging how Americans think of what the presidents do and also Obama in particular. And so it is rather stunning to see him keep coming back to this pretty consistently, which suggests he knows he's saying it and he doesn't mind saying this, even though he's come under immense criticism. But this is that part of the Trump presidency which many people don't find inspirational and think really undercut his ability to move forward on other issues.
And just finally, on international issues, there are many of them. Are you concerned about a confrontation, a very serious confrontation with North Korea?
Sure. I think everyone should be. I think that isn't simply unique to this president, and we've been worried about this certainly since the 1990s. We almost go to war in 94 with North Korea, but it's averted. But now you have this very serious, dangerous situation combined with a president here who can be pretty both combative and reactive to events, and also without much experience himself in these issues. So it's a tinderbox, and this is one of those situations when there is a real problem at hand. And so this is a big test for this president, and just as important for the advisors who surround him, particularly military advisors, whether they can contain and guide that kind of impulse that he has to strike and to attack when attacked.
Mm. Professor Zelizer, always a complete pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Julian Zelizer, he is at Princeton University. He's written a number of books. He is considered a pioneer in a revival of American political history. He's written about George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, national security from World War II to the war on terrorism. You see him frequently on television doing commentary, and he has a weekly column that's at CNN.com.